and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's call today to Republicans to take control and scuttle the Russia investigation and his attack on Senator Feinstein for releasing the transcripts of the Fusion GPS testimony that the Republicans were suppressing. A white-collar criminologist and founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United, William K. Black, distinguished scholar in research for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota, joins us to discuss money laundering and Deutsche Bank, which were the main concerns expressed by the Fusion GPS founders in their testimony released by Senator Feinstein. We'll discuss how over the holidays, Trump quietly waived punishment for convicted mega banks, including Deutsche Bank, and whether Mueller, who has the records of Trump's tangled dealings with Deutsche Bank, who Trump still owes as much as $300 million, will be able to complete his investigation before the Republicans, urged on by the likely guilty party Donald Trump, will be able to get his findings to the public before he is shut down. Then we'll assess the impact on the alt-right and the broader conservative movement of Steve Bannon's spectacular fall from grace, from the top Trump whisperer to sloppy Steve, who has been dumped like a dog, cut off from his financial patron, which in our money-driven political system means you are roadkill. Joseph Lowndes, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, the GOP, race, and elections, joins us to discuss where the battle between the far right and the far, far right stands and whether the government will soon be shut down over Trump's insistence on building a wall. Then finally, we'll examine the unsettled political landscape in Arizona, which has been upended by Sheriff Joe Arpaio's announcement he is running for the U.S. Senate to replace Jeff Flake in a move that may hurt Republicans and help Democrats. A retired judge in Maricopa County, Donna Hamm, the executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, joins us to discuss the likelihood Donald Trump will endorse the 85-year-old former sheriff he pardoned, whose lawless behavior cost Maricopa County millions in settlements as a result of Arpaio's racist, cruel, and sadistic practices. And joining us now is William K. Black, a distinguished scholar in research for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. A white-collar criminologist, he's the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And Bill, I called you because so much of the coverage of the Fusion GPS leak or the making public the transcripts, as the authors had requested in their op-ed in the New York Times by Senator Feinstein, most of the people combing over it are basically talking about the idea that there's possibly a mole in the Trump camp, and he was also referred to as a walk-in. It turns out now that it looks more like that wasn't the case, that in fact this Christopher Steele was referring to the George Papadopoulos and his drunken exchange with an Australian diplomat in London and how that began triggered the FBI investigation. But today Trump has gone after Dianne Feinstein. He calls her sneaky Dianne Feinstein, underhanded and possibly illegal and disgraceful, etc. And then he goes on to tweet out, "The single greatest witch hunt in American history continues. There was no collusion. Everybody, including the Dems, know there's no collusion. And yet on and on it goes. Russia and the world are laughing at the stupidity they are witnessing. Republicans should finally take control." Now, that's pretty menacing, isn't it? The guy's been trying to sabotage the scene behind the scenes, and all the Republican enablers have been doing that. But now he's openly calling on them to shut down the Mueller investigation, isn't he?
On a partisan basis, and simultaneously saying that he wants changes in the libel laws so that he can sue all these people and prevent publication of stories that are critical of him. So, yes, that's authoritarian 651, the grad school version.
Well, obviously, people should recognize that this is the behavior of the Putins and the Erdogans and the Dutertes of the world. I'm not sure that his supporters living in the Fox News bubble have any idea. They're so barraged by stories about Hillary Clinton's emails and Uranium One, they may not even know that about these developments. But what
That's
I was
why Feinstein's action was so critical.
Right.
The Republicans had made this fake criminal referral and were doing everything possible to bury the news. And you can see from the transcripts that the Republicans also were not trying to find the facts about the Russian effort, but were instead focused overwhelmingly on trying to discredit the whistleblower types.
So at this point, Bill Black, it would seem that this is coming to a head, clearly. But what's your sense of what would happen if he was shut down? Would this stuff be able to come out? Because my fear is that the only way to really get Trump out of office is to have a completely unassailable case against him so that his supporters in the Fox bubble, the 35%, many of whom are heavily armed, would finally recognize that their hero is in fact a traitor. And this is what really concerns me, that Rupert Murdoch, who speaks to Trump every day, is actually the most irresponsible and dangerous person on the planet, because he's the one who's feeding all these people this propaganda. And if the case against Trump is not unequivocal, he's basically encouraging the 35% to take the law into their own hands and take to the streets. In this case, they would take the streets with guns. So Murdoch may well end up with blood on his hands. So that's the way I see it. It sounds apocalyptic, but I really think this is becoming such a divisive issue and such a partisan issue. At the end of the day, it could get worse and become an issue that could spark some form of civil unrest.
Well, it's certainly going to be a divisive issue, and it's certain that the Republicans have taken an approach that the Republican Party as a whole has never taken before, that they will simply close ranks and try to prevent any effective investigation if the target of the investigation is Republican. I would also add that it isn't just Murdoch, it's the three M's. It's Murdoch and Mercer and Mercer, the father and daughter, who are funding these efforts. And the Mercers are even wackier in this range, in that they are the basically the alt-right white supremacy type crazies that are using their billionaire status to try to make that mainstream in the United States. It's unlikely, it's very unusual, of course, in investigations to have a drop-dead case of a confession. It can happen when there are tapes. That is the unusual case. The normal case is that you build a case through investigation. And in Mueller, you have one of the best investigators and prosecutors in the United States of America in this particular context, which is elite white-collar crime. Even more than national security. So everybody thinks, in the investigative biz, thinks that Trump's real vulnerability, and that he understands that vulnerability and therefore trots out these attacks. His attacks become more desperate whenever Mueller starts focusing ever more on things like money laundering. And not just money laundering, but money laundering is a classic example. And this is, of course, classically how foreign intelligence services get leverage over people, and that is through the lending function. So the key facts people need to know are that because Trump stiffed so many creditors in the United States, one bankruptcy after another, when, mind you, he could have paid, right? According to what he claims about his wealth, if, you know, that's a big assumption that his claims were true, he could have easily paid all those bankruptcy claims, but chose not to. And then, if people remember, in the first Republican debate, said that all the great ones in real estate follow that same business approach, which tells you how sick real estate and finance are in America today. But in any event, he couldn't borrow anymore in the United States, and the only folks that would lend to him were Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank is a very large German bank that has a terrible reputation, that has been the subject of investigation after investigation in the United States because of its sleazy practices.
Well, this is what I wanted to focus on, actually, Bill. And again, I'm talking with Bill Black, the Distinguished Scholar in Research for Financial Regulation at the University of Minnesota and Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was formerly the director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, investigated the savings and loan disaster in the 1980s, is a white criminologist and the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United, and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank. Now, this is really at the heart of it. First of all, the Fusion GPS guys, in their testimony and in their op-ed piece that they wrote in the New York Times, they said that they really tried to get the government, these three committees they testified before, to focus on money laundering and particularly on Deutsche Bank. And what happened over the holidays was that Donald Trump rather surreptitiously waived this punishment for these convicted banks, including Deutsche Bank. The five biggest banks were convicted of and fined for manipulating global interest rates, and he waived them, and particularly he waived Deutsche Bank, which owes, Trump owes Deutsche Bank at least $130 million personally. And they, of course, been fined for their money laundering role with the Russians. So there, to me, is the real smoking gun. You've looked into this stuff. You've had a career going after these people. How do you see it?
Well, that's exactly what you would focus your investigation on, and you would do exactly what Mueller did. There was a little burst of publicity about 4.5 months ago when Mueller hired onto his team some top people from the IRS. And people assumed that they were focusing on tax violation. That's possible. But the IRS has the best forensic auditors in the world. And that's what is far more likely, that he was looking for that kind of expertise to be able to, as the phrase in the movies goes, is the phrase we use in the real world as investigators, follow the money. So, yes, it's at least $130 million, but we know that because of a disclosure form by President Trump that only gives a range. And Financial Times estimates, or, you know, has reported that Trump's exposure to Deutsche Bank is approximately $300 million, and that over the course of the relationship, the amount of loans he's received from Deutsche Bank is well in excess of $2 billion. In other words, this is his only lifeline, and having a credit lifeline is absolutely essential in the real estate business, which is to say Deutsche Bank has extraordinary leverage over the President of the United States. Further, among those many convictions of Deutsche Bank and many violations that they've been found, and again, it's just one after another for a solid decade, the most prominent is Deutsche Bank helping Russian oligarchs, who are, of course, basically Putin clones, evade U.S. financial sanctions and international financial sanctions on Russia. And Deutsche Bank went so far as to train people in other countries how to commit violations of the sanctions without, while making it extraordinarily difficult for the U.S. regulators to detect it. And so the normal thing that's supposed to happen when you have this kind of criminal record is that you're supposed to be banned from a whole range of activities in the United States. If Deutsche Bank were banned from that whole range of activities, it could not continue to make loans to Trump, and Trump's empire would collapse.
Well, they've loaned him at least $2.5 billion. He defaulted on $640 billion after the financial crash. And Trump then took Deutsche Bank to court and countersued for $3 billion. So they have it's hard to believe that they have a harmonious relationship, but the record against Deutsche Bank is extraordinary. Just in the last minute then, what's the chance of, since the Republicans are trying to stop this thing, the two guys from Fusion GPS told the committees to look into Deutsche Bank. Is it going to happen? Mueller's already subpoenaed the record, so it sounds like he's got the goods, doesn't he?
Probably he has much of it, but then you have to follow up, not with just records, but with depositions and testimony in front of grand juries under oath and such of key Deutsche Bank personnel and real estate personnel on the deals. As you say, it's a long, complicated, nasty relationship in which Trump has made many bogus claims against Deutsche Bank. And what's remarkable is that Deutsche Bank still loans money to someone that on any normal basis, you would not only not lend to them, as soon as they came in the room, you would run.
Well, Bill Black, I thank you for joining us here today. And let's stay in touch and try and follow up on this story.
Right. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in research for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He's a white-collar criminologist and the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the impact on the alt-right and the broader conservative movement of Steve Bannon's fall from grace. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Joseph Lowndes. A professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, the GOP, race, and elections. He's the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and co-editor of Race and American Political Development. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Lowndes.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian.
And I'm interested in getting your take on the downfall of Stephen Bannon and what that will mean in terms of the conservative movements in this country, Breitbart, of course, being an important, in fact, Bannon himself said that Breitbart is the sort of platform for the alt-right, but it's lost, I think, since its peak with the election in 2016, in November of 2016, from its peak then, it's down 53%. So something's happening there, clearly, and now, of course, it's capped by the firing of Bannon himself. So what's happening within the conservative movement is Bannon's Breitbart because of its racism and nationalism and far-right tilt. Are they alienating the rest of the conservative movement? I'm trying to get a handle on whether or not Bannon was too far to the right for the far-right in this country.
That's a great question, and I think that there are a lot of moving parts, and so it's difficult. I also have a hard time grasping exactly what's going on, but I guess I think what, you know, in some ways the location of the far right has shifted since Trump's election. I mean, suddenly you have a person in the White House who appears in many ways to be representative of political positions associated with the alt-right. Or white nationalism, or what Bannon would like to call populist nationalism. So, and which of course doesn't really describe the Trump administration itself entirely, although it does in certain respects. But partly what happened is that, you know, once Trump is in power, the position of Breitbart as an oppositional news site becomes questionable, because they no longer have the same kind of, you know, they now have their guy in the White House, and so what, you know, what kind of role are they going to play? Is it to be principled outsiders and critics of power, or is it to have some kind of access to power in the White House? And I think that that is a question that people of Breitbart were not able to sufficiently answer, and I think still have not sufficiently answered that question for themselves. I mean, there are particular players here that have more influence than others. And I think, in particular, the story of Robert Mercer and his daughter, Rebecca Mercer, the billionaire hedge fund manager and his daughter, who were big, you know, kind of the big money behind Breitbart and close to Trump. And I think that, you know, partly, you know, a couple months ago, Robert Mercer was asked to step down as CEO of Renaissance Technologies, and partly because he was seen as such a far-right crank, I think, by people on his own board, by shareholders, by other kind of other people around him, that he became too controversial, so he stepped down. And his daughter, Rebecca, who I think is more careful but probably holds the same kind of hard right positions, particularly on things like immigration, you know, kind of took over. And she is really the one, I think, that kind of calls the shots at Breitbart in terms of questions like these, and certainly in terms of Bannon's kind of forced resignation. So, you know, I think they value their access to Trump, and all the reports coming out of the White House seem to indicate that Trump essentially said to all of his support, people in and outside the White House who were his supporters, that they had to choose between him and Bannon. And so partly it's about personalities, partly it's about where people are positioned in these kind of broader milieus, and it's partly about politics itself. So I think in some ways, you know, once everybody was forced to choose, once Trump himself said you have to choose, I think that Rebecca Mercer, in particular, said, okay, well, we're going to make Breitbart not an antagonistic source. And so that's one part of it. Then if you think about Bannon himself, you know, he was put in kind of a difficult position. I mean, I have to say, I thought, and I may have said this here on your show, that once he was forced out of the White House and then by the end of the day took up the reins at Breitbart, he said, and with some credibility, that he was going to use Breitbart to really force the administration from the outside, to really push from the outside the kind of hard right populist agenda that his vision of the Trump administration had been all along. But the problem was Breitbart is a news site and not a social movement. It's not like the civil rights movement. It's not even like the pro-life movement. It's not something that has an organized, coherent force in the world. And so it's unclear how Bannon was going to use that position to really push and put pressure on the Trump administration. It's not like the civil rights movement pushing Lyndon Johnson in the mid-1960s. It doesn't have that kind of character or organization. So it was unclear what kind of influence Bannon was going to be able to have, what kind of leverage he was going to be able to have over the Trump administration. I think that he placed his bet on primary races coming up in 2018, and before that, obviously, the Alabama special election in particular, as a place where he was going to push the kind of the populist far-right agenda. In the Republican Party, he lost, you know, Roy Moore lost, and that I think a lot of people pin that on Bannon as a particular loss for him. And so I think it was, you know, at that point, it was unclear, you know, he had a diminished influence, I think, among people in the Trump administration. I think he's also, you know, so I think politically, in structural terms, Bannon was kind of caught between two places, and he was not able to deliver on his promises and threats. And so he became, you know, someone who was more dispensable than he might have been otherwise. And I think secondly, you know, he doesn't seem like a kind of a principled movement martyr in anything. He kind of presents himself as kind of a huckster and a wheeler dealer. And so, you know, when someone like that looks incompetent or looks like he can't do what he says he's going to do or looks like he's kind of blowing smoke, I think it tends to irritate everyone, even people, you know, on the far right. I think that his kind of position there was kind of diminishing in the same way that it was diminished for people in the Trump administration. And certainly the hostility to Bannon, which was felt by conservatives, you know, at the National Review, at the Weekly Standard, by the GOP in Congress, by the Republican National Committee more generally. So it's not like, you know, there was no real, unless the alt-right had a coherent political structure or movement, a street movement force, there was really not much that Bannon was going to be able to do, I think.
But I think the bottom line, surely, Joseph, is that he just butted heads with Trump, and it was either him or Trump. And that's an uneven battle, given that Trump still has something 80% approval amongst his base. And it's pretty incomprehensible why Bannon, who on the one hand keeps talking about how much he admires Trump and sees him as a great man, is completely in his corner. Why he decided to butt heads with him is absolutely incomprehensible, and maybe Trump was right in saying the guy lost his mind.
Well, I think, you know, Bannon had hoped that things were going to go in a different direction than they did. Maybe he thought that Trump was someone politically who he wasn't. There are some lingering questions out there which may not become, are not acute right now, I think, for Trump's base, but may become that over the next few months, and DACA being the key one. If Trump finds a way to make a deal to allow DACA to continue, it's going to anger his, you know, kind of the racist and restrictionist base of the party. If he's unable to build a wall, that's going to, I think, redound on him in ways that make him unappealing to his party. And I think those are the things that Bannon thought, we're gonna stand firm on questions of the wall, on immigration, on free trade, you know, all these things which were, you know, signal elements of Bannon's version of Trumpism, I guess. And Trump has not delivered on any of those things. But what Trump has actually gotten are the successes he's had are kind of establishment GOP successes, the biggest one, of course, being the recent tax bill. So in a way, Trump has been partly embraced and absorbed by broader Republican Party imperatives, and has kind of left behind some of the elements of the kind of far-right kind of authoritarian nationalism that he represented before. And I think that's where Bannon was. And I think that Bannon placed his bets on this being a movement. You know, Bannon used to talk about this is going to be we're going to have a realignment, which looks like 1932. It's going to be an historic realignment in American politics that's going to utterly transform the landscape, transform both major political parties, usher in a new era where the political questions being debated will be much more in line with the populist national vision that Trump ran on. And this is how Bannon saw it. He saw, you know, himself as helping to birth something like the Jacksonian era of the 1830s or the New Deal era of the 1930s. And I think that that's the thing that Bannon kind of had fantasy wishes about, and that's why he held firm on that line. He really saw this as something as a world historic or certainly national historic moment, which was going to have, you know, be felt decades and decades into the future. And, you know, that's not, Bannon is always a subject of kind of romantic longings and kind of epic thoughts about, you know, broad historical, you know, his favorite book is this book, The Fourth Turning, this historical, rendering of eras, which radically transformed the world. He really deeply believes that we were in one of those. And also, you know, his deep antipathy to people of color, to immigrants, to the global South, to black and brown people, to Muslims, was really something that animated his political vision as well. And, you know, Trump is going to have to navigate a world where, he certainly has a lot of people who seem to be still have some elements of those politics that they want to advance. Certainly Stephen Miller, certainly Jeff Sessions. But, you know, it's a more complicated thing when you are the president and in the White House and managing all kinds of things and the things coming at you, 24 hours a day. So I think, you know, Bannon was a fantasist in some ways, and I think that he thought that he could hold out that vision of his dream, you know, all the way to the end.
Well, it's obvious that the showdown between Trump and Bannon, who lost there, and it was, I think it should have been obvious from day one, which makes it a little incomprehensible. But the next showdown is over this wall and DACA. And the Democrats are saying no to the wall, yes to DACA. Trump is saying yes to DACA, but you've got to give me the wall. And in the mix there, you have the possibility of the government being shut down. And my feeling is the Democrats aren't going to budge. Trump's not going to be able to budge. And the government may well be shut down.
Yeah, we may be headed towards that. And this is, you know, these are always moments of when people place their bets as to who, generally it breaks one way or the other in terms of where blame is laid when the government shuts down. And I think that Democrats are hoping to be able to stand firm on this issue of both the wall and DACA. I think Trump is hoping to stand firm on the position of building the wall, because his credibility really rests on it. So I think it's going to be a decisive moment, and I think we're headed into this in a way that there's no clear outcome. But I don't think that either the Democrats nor Trump hold all the cards here.
Right, but if you pull back and look at this objectively, this wall, you have to come to the conclusion that if it happens, then America has truly lost its mind. The idea of building something that's so futile, so stupid, so atavistically insane and unworkable and a huge waste of money at a time when programs are being cut right, left, and center, it's obscene when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. No question. I mean, it's a crazy idea, and it is awful in so many ways, and as you said, it's insane. I think, but it's the thing that, you know, if you saw footage of Trump rallies during the election cycle of 2016, the one rallying cry that everyone would always come back to was build the wall, build the wall, build the wall, and it's kind of a infantile fantasy of protection, you know, that this wall is going to go up and this thing's going to be there and we're going to be protected by it from Latin American labor and Latin American culture and from brown skin. And, you know, it's all just ludicrous, but it is the thing that it's really the fantasy that really, I think it's the key thing that propelled Trump past his 17 rivals in the primaries. And so it's the very thing he himself may realize at this point how ludicrous it is, but he can hardly say I was just kidding, or now I think it's a bad idea, about the very thing that sure. Animated that base.
Well, then you get back to the reality that we have a tyranny of the minority. If this goes through, and I can't see the Democrats buckling on this, but if they do, and if the government has to be shut down and somehow they have to throw a bone to Trump and give him some money for this ridiculous waste of money, then again, it goes back to pandering to a minority. And the question you always come up with is, what the hell's wrong with the majority in this country? If Trump's only got 35%, that means 65%, you got 65% to work with. Why can't we create a critical mass with 65% of the population and bring some sanity back to the United States?
That's a great question. I mean, partly, you know, this points to the fundamentally undemocratic nature of the Constitution. You know, the Electoral College obviously is something that can thwart the will of majority of voters, and also, you know, the role of the executive, which the anti-federalists at the time of the founding always feared that, you know, too much power is centralized in this office, and in relation to the other branches, in relation to the states, in relationship to the people as a whole. And so we're kind of stuck in this moment. I think in the long run, you know, I think that Republicans understand that in some ways time is up for them. You know, the demographics are, you know, race and age and increasingly gender demographics are moving in the opposite direction. The Republicans can, you know, can only do so much to double down on voter suppression and other ways of kind of, you know, stopping a Democratic vote. But ultimately, it's not a sustainable program for the Republicans. But that's kind of where they are, and that's kind of the place where they share this with Trump. And this is why I think that the tax bill was essentially, you know, they almost weren't even making ideological arguments for it. I mean, they're making kind of trickle-down economics arguments, but, you know, not even ways that they seem particularly convinced by. That their donors said, you pass this thing and you redistribute wealth to the very richest Americans in this radical way, or your funds are going to be dried up for your next election. And so there's a way in which I think Republicans are kind of stuck in this moment, and it's kind of a last gasp at what kind of assets they can strip while in power at this moment. And this is partly about race, and it's partly about economics in terms of what their imperatives and initiatives are. But I don't see it lasting for a long time. But for the moment, it keeps Trump in a camp with his Republican allies in the House and Senate, and they're going to hold firm and work together as long as they can, I think.
Well, Joseph Lowndes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian. It was nice to talk to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Lowndes, who's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, the GOP, race, and elections. He's the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and co-editor of Race and American Political Development. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the unsettled political landscape in Arizona, which has been upended by Sheriff Joe Arpaio's announcement he's running for the U.S. Senate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Donna Hamm, a retired judge who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system. She is a former lower court judge in Coconino and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donna Hamm.
Thank you.
And the fact that Joe Arpaio, the disgraced former sheriff of Maricopa County, has thrown his hat in the ring in terms of running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona looks like it's causing quite a great deal of political ripples there amongst the Republicans, and the consensus is that it may well end up being a gift for the Democrats. But let's start with, since Donald Trump pardoned Arpaio, is it likely that Trump will endorse him? I mean, that seems to be pretty logical, isn't it, Donna?
Well, it certainly seems like that is more realistic than it is for any other candidate, including Kelly Ward, who seems to be distancing herself a little bit because she was originally endorsed by Steve Bannon, and now she's backing away from that. So I think this is the latest stunt by Joe Arpaio, and I do think that not only could this benefit Democrats, but it may benefit another Republican who has not formally announced yet, but is who is anticipated, and that is Representative McNally. And she may enter the race, and if she does, I think what will happen in the Republican primary is that Arpaio and Ward will split whatever votes the ultra-conservative Republicans would get, and then she would get the remainder of them and possibly most of them.
Well, that would be on the assumption that, as we know in primaries, the more motivated and zealous members of the party, which means on the Republican side, the far right, and on the Democratic side, the far left or the left, as opposed to the center. In this case, is there enough moderate Republicans left that are likely to vote in the primary?
In Arizona?
In Arizona.
Yes, I think there are. And I think, you know, Joe Arpaio has some distinct advantages. He has a lot of money. He's able to raise money, or at least he did in the past. But he certainly has a war chest. And he has name recognition all over the state, although he has never run for any office outside of just Maricopa County. So he's never even run a district legislative race, much less a statewide race. So while his name is clearly known throughout the state, it is an unknown quantity about just exactly how many voters he would attract on a statewide basis. But he also has a lot of baggage, and I think most people know about that, a ton of baggage. And so what if Martha McSally runs, I think she is the Republican candidate who is capable of giving the Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, who's the likely Democratic candidate, a run for her money. Because they're both, actually, Sinema and McSally are both Republicans for all intents and purposes. Sinema votes 48% of the time with Republican issues.
Well, Sinema is an interesting character, though, is she not? She's openly bisexual, and as you say, she's a conservative Democrat. But McNally's also got a pretty interesting resume. She's a former A-10 attack pilot, Air Force pilot, and as you say, she's likely to be the beneficiary of Arpaio's splitting the ultra-conservative vote with so-called Chemtrails Kelly, who is the protege of Stephen Bannon, who's now out of a job and somewhat disgraced. It's all rather interesting, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it's definitely going to be a race to watch, and that's why I think that even the voters who don't necessarily vote in primary elections may come out for this one, because by August, late August, when our primary is held, it should be perfectly clear to the state population about the importance of who they support and how they should support. And that would obviously include not just with donations, but also with a vote. And so I think people will go to the polls who don't necessarily go. But independents in Arizona are not allowed to vote in the primaries. At least I don't believe they are. And so that may be a problem with getting, not knowing what that vote will be.
But at this point, though, polling released yesterday from ABC 15 TV in Phoenix shows Joe Arpaio skyrocketing to the top of the Republican primary for U.S. Senate in Arizona. And that's obviously with a hypothetical endorsement from Trump, would bump that up even further. So I'm trying to figure this out. Do you think that he's going to be, obviously, if this early poll is any indication, he's on a fast track, shall we say. The other side of it is that the more Arpaio rises in prominence and in the polls, the more support Kyrsten Sinema will get from donors. I mean, already she's tweeted out today, Arizona's deserve leaders who work together to solve our country's greatest challenges. Joe Arpaio is not that person. Together we'll defeat Sheriff Joe's dangerous actions and tired rhetoric. Well, apparently money is just pouring into Kyrsten Sinema, and Democratic senators, California's Kamala Harris and Connecticut's Chris Murphy are encouraging their supporters to donate to her. So it looks as if Arpaio is going to be a massive fundraising boon for Kyrsten Sinema.
Indeed, he probably will, but he'll also be able to get funds himself. He always has. And keep in mind that the entire time he ran for sheriff, a vast amount of his money came from out-of-state supporters. And so he never really relied on Arizona voters to support him financially. He certainly got the votes until the last election, but he didn't get his money from those sources. And it would be reasonable to assume that those sources and more will support his Senate candidacy simply because they want to support a Trump Republican. And so he'll be raising money from out of state. And, and so will Kyrsten Sinema, obviously, if other senators are encouraging their supporters to support her as well. It's a long way to go until August, and so many things can unfold. Another factor for Joe Arpaio, I hate to sound as though I'm discriminating by age, but he is 85 years old and will be 86 if he were elected by the time he took office. And I think that, if you just look at the insurance actuarial tables, he would not even be expected to survive and live a single term. And I think that voters will take that into account. I believe that the biggest boon for having Joe Arpaio enter the race is to Martha McSally if she enters the race, because Republicans are going to fight very, very hard to retain this Republican-held Senate seat. There's no question of that.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the age, 85, and he'd be 86 if he wins. That means after his first six-year term in the Senate, he'd be 92. This is coming up here in California with Dianne Feinstein running for another term. Kevin DeLeon, a younger and fairly charismatic young politician here in the state, he's challenging her. But she's suddenly gotten a big boost because she released these transcripts of the Fusion GPS testimony before the Judiciary Committee, which Senator Grassley had been sitting on, and that's sort of given her a boost with Californians' liberal voters who thought she was a little bit too conservative. So she may well get another term. So there's no telling, is there?
Really? And I think part of that can be explained. I mean, look, Joe Arpaio has never done anything except be a county sheriff. And it's questionable about how well that qualifies him to be a state senator, a United States senator. And so Dianne Feinstein, I think, comes in a little different category, even though there may be an age factor for some people with her. Certainly, her opponent will collect some votes based on age alone, but she has experience and she has voter approval in the current job, and Joe Arpaio does not have that.
Right.
He's not a proven quantity except as an elected sheriff, and there it's a pretty dismal record if someone looks at it with an unbiased eye.
Well, Donald Trump, in his tweet storm today, attacked Senator Feinstein. So, again, all that does is help her get reelected. But what about the conditions of the pardon? Is a presidential pardon absolute? Because I had read somewhere that Arpaio is not entirely off the hook. As a former judge, do you know anything about his legal jeopardy, if any?
Well, I don't think that that's true now. I think that a judge upheld, a judge recognized the pardon, dismissed the case, but it has not been expunged from his record. So the only thing that he didn't get that he wanted was he did not get an expungement of the record. But the pardon itself is absolute, and I don't think he has any worries about that being declared illegal or withdrawn at any time in the future. Presidential pardons are except under cases of fraud, would be very difficult to overturn.
So that he's no way could be disqualified from running for the
U.S. Senate. I don't believe so, no.
Right.
I don't think that is of concern. I think what has happened, though, the pardon has added to his record rather than deleted the record of the conviction, so that if you were a criminal justice agency checking his criminal history background, you would see that he was, in fact, convicted of this misdemeanor, but that a pardon was subsequently issued. And so the record stands. It's just that as a result of the pardon, legally he cannot suffer any consequences of the conviction. So obviously he can't be placed in jail or put on probation or fined or denied a job or a license solely based on the conviction, because a pardon simply eliminates the consequences of the conviction.
So we're talking about Arpaio running for this seat vacated by Senator Jeff Flake, who was a victim of Trump, clearly. He criticized Trump, and Trump won. Justice Bannon criticized Trump, and Trump won. So this is the reality. But what's happening with the other seat? Senator McCain, from what I understand, is in very, very dire health at the moment. What would happen if he were to pass soon, which may well be the case? The governor, of course...
Well, bless his heart, he is struggling, and I think the public posture from his team is that he is fighting and making progress and just taking a rest. But I think he understands that his time here is probably limited. And there, of course, will be an appointment. If he passes, there will be an appointment by the governor to his position, which opens that one wide up, except that will be required to be a Republican. So some people have even speculated that Governor Ducey himself, who is the person who will do the appointment, that he would appoint himself, because there's, of course, been political talk that the governor wishes to proceed to higher office. So that's something, though, that's entirely open for speculation, and no one, thankfully, is seriously discussing it right now, because Senator McCain is very much still holding the position and I hope that he does.
Well, how long has his term got? In other words, how long would this governor, if he appointed himself, be in that that seat?
I believe that Senator McCain's position expires in 2020.
I see.
He has two more years his term.
So we already went through the Roy Moore situation in Alabama, and there was a great deal of alarm, the idea that a child molester, an alleged child molester, could be elected to the United States Senate. To my mind, Donna Hamm, this horrible racist, Joe Arpaio, he's not just a racist, he's cruel and sadistic, and he's cost Maricopa County millions and millions of dollars in settlements. His record is appalling. I'm not sure that he's any better than Roy Moore. I mean, it's a different kind of disgracefulness, but still, it's pretty appalling, isn't it, that this guy even has a chance of becoming a U.S. senator?
Well, I think the election is going to tell us a lot about Arizona, and it will be very, very, it'll either be gratifying or horrifying, depending upon the outcome. And I think that's what we're going to see here, is just how much Arizonans are willing to tolerate in a person of his beliefs and practices and character. And it'll be on a statewide basis. So it will be an opportunity to really test what Arizonans are willing to tolerate on this level. So I think I wouldn't predict, because many, many things have happened in the state that are appalling and surprising, and it's just too early to predict because a lot could happen. You know, Joe Arpaio, my interactions with him, and we had a lot of them over the time, the couple of decades that he was sheriff, and my impression is that he really is not a well-rounded, well-researched, well-versed person on anything other than the very, very narrow things that he spoke about as sheriff. And even then, he spoke incorrectly and often in violation of the law. So I don't have great expectations for him to come forth with an intelligent discourse over the various issues that need to be discussed. He better be boning up if he's running for office. I hope he's got some people teaching him about water rights and veterans' rights and schools and education and healthcare, military, et cetera, because he has never dealt with those issues at all.
Well, Donna Hamm, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Donna Hamm, who's a retired judge who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system. She is a former lower court judge in Coconino and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.